You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Most of the former politicians working in TV these days are conservatives, major contributors to the lineup on Fox, but not Elliot Spitzer. Recently, New York's former attorney general and governor has returned to the anchor desk at Current TV with a show called Viewpoint with Elliot Spitzer, where he and his guests break down the news of the day. It airs nightly at 8 p.m. Eastern, and I'm very pleased to welcome Elliot Spitzer back to our show. Hello.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
The launch of the show seemed to be pretty sudden. Had you been having conversations with Al Gore and CEO Joel Hyatt at Current TV for a while?
No, it was a brief, and look, I think everybody knows Keith Olbermann had been there at 8 o'clock, and Keith is an enormous talent. That show came to an end, and the events there speak for themselves.
So then they called you immediately after?
Well, it was not after. It was just shortly before. As those events were transpiring, I guess the end was clear, but it was just a very brief period of time.
And you had already spent some time as a host at CNN. Did that whet your appetite for doing another talk show?
Well, you are a host. You understand both the joy of it as well as, to some extent, the limitation. Yes, I enjoyed it. It is fun to do a live program where you have the opportunity to interview interesting people, talk about the events of the moment, and participate in the debate that ongoes.
But did you find it strange to find yourself on the other side of the desk as the interviewer instead of the interviewee?
Initially, yes. Although I will tell you that to a certain extent, over time, I began to understand or think of my role in government, perhaps a bit more as governor than as attorney general, as a participant in a discussion and merely one of many voices trying to lead, to form a consensus about what to do with tough issues. As attorney general, it's a little different. You can bring cases. As a governor, oddly enough, you're merely one of many voices, so you have to try to build the consensus. That's what you do as a talk show host.
Although I would think that your experience as a lawyer and former politician would help. But
oh, sure.
On the one hand, many people feel that if you are interviewing somebody who is already in the business, you're going to have an easier time because they know what you want from them.
To some extent.
You've been on both sides.
I've been on both sides. Look, the biggest problem I have is sometimes instead of referring to guests as guests, I call them witnesses. And, you know, I've done that most frequently in the office when we're trying to figure out who do we want to show up in the evening. And people kind of look at me and say, "Now, Elliot, you're no longer attorney general. This is TV.
We don't book them. We subpoena them."
Exactly. You know, that used to be easier. I say, what do you mean we have to worry about their showing up? Where's the subpoena? Get them here. They'll answer the questions. But no, it's all good fun.
Do you know from personal experience how politicians and their spokespeople try to weasel out of having to answer a tough question?
Some do, of course. And I know I can call them on the carpet sometimes. But frankly, the wiser politicians will avoid putting themselves in the context where they know they're going to be asked the hard question. Now, there's some – we were chatting off air just a moment ago. I don't want to speak out of school, but how Alphonse D'Amano is a master at both being smart, clever, and not giving you the precise answer. Alphonse is smart enough and good enough to show up and have fun at it. A lot of folks understand, or their staff understands, they shouldn't be put in the context. They just don't appear on the shows.
What are you hoping to do with the show?
Well, look, what differentiates Current from CNN, and I say this with a lot of respect for what CNN does and tries to do, but at Current, Al Gore and Joel Hyatt, who together have been building the network, we are avowedly a progressive voice. And so it is easier for me to let my politics become apparent. I have a segment every night called My View where I actually editorialize, so I enjoy that. So what we're trying to do is give voice to a progressive perspective, but do it in a way that is not simply argumentative or is not superficial. We really want, and I encourage guests to come on who disagree with me, to have a very civil discourse about where we agree and where we don't.
So let's talk about some of the issues in the news and that are being debated. There's been a lot of debate about how the White House talked about the killing of Osama bin Laden as the anniversary of the death approached. In the last few days, we've heard former Governor Mitt Romney say that even Jimmy Carter would have ordered the attack, and that was countered by the Obama campaign questioning whether Romney would have given the order for the operation that killed bin Laden. Are you surprised by the tenor of the conversation?
No, I'm not surprised. It is inevitable between now and November, every issue will be shrouded in politics.
But sometimes you bring up an issue that might actually hurt you in the end, won't it?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. Look,
Romney is vulnerable in all sorts of things, and Obama is vulnerable in all sorts of things.
I will tell you something. I think that the Obama administration actually made a tactical mistake in letting this become political. They were it was fair game, and they were right to raise it, right to celebrate it, right for the White House to say the president made a very tough decision. And Mitt Romney's statement, even Jimmy Carter, sort of dismissive of the difficulties and the risks, dead wrong about that. The White House should have raised it, but they would have been better to keep off that last bit. Mitt Romney wouldn't have done it.
Is Jimmy Carter being given a bad rap here? Although it didn't work, didn't he order an attempt to free the hostages in the American embassy in Tehran?
Yes, he is.
The same kind of decision.
He is given a bad rap at many different levels. And the historic place of presidents is keyed to such a great extent to how the economy fared during their term that Jimmy Carter was dealt an unfortunate hand. The economy did not begin to come back until after he left office, of course.
OPEC was founded at that time.
And we were pushed into a deep recession because of oil prices and other macroeconomic factors. Now, if you go back and listen to his speeches, you will take away the notion that, man, he was actually quite prescient about the issues we should have been thinking about. And so I think that's why everybody says he was a better post-president than president, because it's easier to appreciate him intellectually in that capacity, even though he was correct in much of what he said. Now, he didn't have the charisma, the sort of leadership skills of President Reagan, with whom I disagreed on so many fundamental things, but you look at him as a politician and say, yes, he was good.
President Obama spoke from Kabul last night to mark the anniversary of the killing of Osama bin Laden. He also signed a strategic partnership agreement about the continuing U.S. presence in Afghanistan after American troops leave in 2014. Do you see this as a new page in our relationship with Afghanistan, especially in the light of the fact that the president promised a lot more success in Afghanistan when he was running for office?
I see this as the last chapter. This is a departure strategy. And it is a hope and a prayer that we can withdraw our troops. The president is absolutely correct and deserves credit that al-Qaeda, to a great extent, has been destroyed. That has been a consequence of the drones of covert operations that have been very successful. Frankly,
but the issue in Afghanistan is Taliban, not
well,
the al-Qaeda.
We'll get to that in a second. That's why it has been unclear to many of us and to the public at large, I think, what was our strategic purpose in being there. And the president never quite pinned it down. Last night, he tried to say, we've destroyed al-Qaeda. The Taliban can be part of a peace movement. Therefore, we can leave. His first point, I think, is correct. Al-Qaeda has, to a great extent, been destroyed. Whether the Taliban is willing to be part of a peace with Karzai, I don't know, but certainly not much to support that notion. But we will leave and then say to Karzai, you're on your own. We are done.
Based on your own experience when you were dealing with the New York State Legislature, do politicians have to settle for what they can actually get rather than what they have promised to get?
Sometimes, sure. I think the question is not whether you want to or must at a certain point agree to compromises that, you know, you can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good most of the time, certainly on budget matters where you must get a budget passed. The question is the degree to which you have the fortitude and the backbone to stand up for tough, principled fights in order to create the environment where you can then negotiate from strength. And I think the issue with President Obama, to leave the state legislature to the side for the moment, but to bring it back to Washington, the issue has been, did he concede too quickly and not stand up along the way, even on budget issues, on tax issues, on civil rights issues? You know, not to make the White House Correspondents' Dinner more than it is, but even Jimmy Kimmel on Saturday night poked fun at the president for his unwillingness to negotiate with the Republican parties from strength.
My guest is Elliot Spitzer. He has a new show on Current TV called Viewpoint with Elliot Spitzer. It airs weeknights at 8 p.m. Eastern. Okay, let's talk about the handling of the economy. You've criticized the president for what's happened with financial reform over the last 4 years. Do you disagree with the argument that many of the banks were too big to fail?
Oh, the problem I have with the White House is that the banks are still too big to fail.
Although we've seen two banks, two very big banks, in serious trouble, Bank of America and
yes.
Citibank.
And the reason they continue to be in serious trouble is that we did not mandate sufficient structural reform back at the moment of crisis. And oddly, I think there was a very – look, Paul Krugman is the economist. Joe Stiglitz and Paul Krugman are, I think, the most prescient, smartest economists out there. Their writings are mandatory reading, I think, for folks.
Paul Krugman was on our show yesterday, and we talked about this.
Yes, and well, in that case, I will merely say, listen to Paul. What more can I add? He won the Nobel Prize. I'm just a guy who took a bunch of econ courses in college. Having said that, I would also point, and this shows you that I think there's an interesting political agreement from right and left, Warren Stevens, who runs the Stevens Bank, an investment bank in Little Rock, Arkansas, a major institution, but not on a par with the Wall Street firms whose names are more typically known. He wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal saying TBTF, too big to fail, still a major problem. Slim down these banks, get rid of the explicit federal guarantees. It breeds risk-taking and behavior that is dangerous for our economy.
Actually, most of them are bigger than they were before.
Absolutely.
They were too big to fail.
The banking system is more concentrated now than it was in 2007 because the process of bailing them out led to a concentration where the biggest would buy back or buy those that were failing, and this was the wrong way to go.
Do you think that it was a mistake that the president has kept so much of the same economic team in place since he took office?
Well, yes. I mean, I hate to personalize this because these are hardworking folks who are trying to do what they believe in. I just think they're wrong in some of the fundamental decisions. I called his financial leadership team early on, rather than change, you can believe it. I said it was continuity you can believe in. And you had Tim Geithner, who had been the president of the New York Fed, the single most important position in terms of examining leverage ratios, the behavior and risk tolerance of the banks. He was elevated from the position where he had overseen the creation of the very fraught system that took us over the precipice. He then became Treasury Secretary. Now, Tim's a good, decent guy, but I think he didn't appreciate the need for structural reform.
Does having the former head of Bain Capital as an opponent mean that the president will have to defend his record in this area a little less?
Well, I think we have a rather stark contrast. I think that the record of Bain is now fair game. And I think, look, private equity, I have no problem with private equity, just the opposite. I think those who invest take risk and create companies. That's what capitalism is and should be. The problem is whether the business model of some of the investments that Bain pursued was really one of outsourcing the jobs in a way that may have been good for Bain, but not good for the country or the economy.
Well, have you seen the new ads that criticize Mitt Romney for having had a Swiss bank account? Don't most wealthy people, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, have bank accounts in places like Switzerland and the Cayman Islands?
I hope not. I mean, honestly, my experience is
well, if your accountant says to you, you know, right, you got a lot of money here, you're going to be taxed at a very high rate.
Right.
Now, all we have to do is put some of it here and put some of it there, and you'll be taxed at a much lower rate. Most people are going to say, okay,
maybe
give me the 15% over the 38%.
Maybe so, although, look, I don't know. I don't go around asking people if you have a Swiss bank account. I will tell you, when I was in office, and maybe this is a silly story to tell, I was the only one. I would go to my accountant and say, if I pay less than 30%, you're fired. The last thing I wanted was to have to deal with, gee, why aren't you paying a fair percentage? And for now, more recently, I'm still paying 30%. Another reason to fire him, perhaps. But I believe that people should keep their funds here. That's what patriotism is about. You don't take those types of steps to shift your tax burden. I think we need fundamental tax equity, fairness, and reform.
Well, or do you just shift them to Reno, Nevada?
Well, look, the story about Apple that was in the Sunday New York Times about how Apple has used international and also within the United States tax differentials to minimize its tax burden, all of it was legal. Nothing illegal, so it's hard to criticize them at that level, but it does show you how the system can be gamed in a way that breeds fundamental inequity. Look, we shouldn't forget, President Obama's marginal rate was only 20%. So as the other side has rightly pointed out, his secretary pays more than he does as well. It shows you, again, the problems here are not limited just to one side of the aisle. The incentive to act this way applies to everybody.
My guest is Eliot Spitzer. He has a new show called Viewpoint with Eliot Spitzer, which airs weeknights at 8 p.m. Eastern on Current TV. What channel is that on?
103 on Time Warner. 103 on Time Warner. You have to scroll up a little higher.
Which is where most New Yorkers get their cable.
Absolutely.
And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Eliot Spitzer, who has a new television show called Viewpoint with Eliot Spitzer. It airs weekday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern on Current TV. As Attorney General, you were very aggressive in prosecuting crimes on Wall Street. Are you surprised by the relatively few prosecutions that we've seen so far in connection with the financial meltdown?
I'm surprised and I'm disappointed, needless to say. I think it stands in contrast to what happened during the SNL crisis 15, 20 years ago when there were many, many prosecutions. And I think it is unfortunately symptomatic of prosecutors being unwilling to push hard and take risks and tell the truth.
And why do you think that is? Paul Krugman said yesterday that one of the ironies of the current situation is that the Wall Street firms are all giving a lot of money to the Republican candidates this year.
Well, it's true.
You think
funny.
They'd be more grateful?
Well, exactly. They hate the White House regardless of the fact that they have been coddled, in my view, coddled by the White House. The rhetoric has been a bit edgy out of the Oval Office occasionally, but Wall Street has gotten precisely what it wanted. And I had thought Wall Street would be more sophisticated, saying, okay, let them talk a tough game. We're really doing fine. Instead, they continue to turn their back. And the quintessential moment for me was when the president invited the CEOs of the firms down to the Oval Office or the Cabinet Room. And he said, I am the only thing that stands between you and the pitchforks. FDR would have said, I'm holding the pitchfork. And so the negotiation between the Oval Office and the firms that really played an instrumental role in destroying our economy was never calibrated quite properly.
A documentary film suggested that the Bush administration went after you as a payback for how you'd angered some powerful people on Wall Street. Do you think that's true?
Oh, look, I don't know. I don't think about it at this point in my life. I've tried to be forthright
But the suggestion is that if you go after powerful people, they know ways to bring you down.
Look, that's certainly true. But again, I don't want to personalize this. I will just tell one little story, which is about either amusing or not. It was before we filed one major case against a very, very significant Wall Street firm. The lawyer for the other side called me and said, Elliot, be careful. We have powerful friends, which I laughed at him. And I said, well, how do you expect me to react to that? Now I'm going to cower under a rock and say, oh, thank you for telling me. So, you know, you know that, but be a grown up about it.
Do you think that one of the problems is that the reasons that the White House has been cautious in going after these Wall Street people is that it's hard to prove that these bankers were acting criminally as opposed to just being stupid?
Yes. Look,
hard to make the case?
It is hard to make the case, but that doesn't mean you don't do it. Look, the job of a prosecutor is to make the hard cases. There were some examples, many examples, where people were following the herd. They were stupid. They bought into the notion that the market was going to rise and that these products were actually good. But there were other criminal cases that should have been brought. And I've seen documents that would actually support those criminal cases and civil cases against the companies. And the virtue of those cases is they would have generated pressure for genuine reform, which is what we did not get. And so there are many reasons that the White House should have pushed much, much harder. Justice should have pushed harder. And I'm disappointed in that fact.
Just because it would have given publicity to the excesses. And
the way you reform.
Everything seems to have been swept under the rug.
We are beginning to revert to a deja vu all over again. World where finance is repeating the same mistakes, and there has not been the reform. I love to recommend the book by John Kenneth Galbraith, Short History of Financial Euphoria, written in 1987 after the prior series of crashes, captures perfectly the narcotic of leverage, the failure to remedy properly, and the sort of symptomatic failure to understand what drives Wall Street.
Well, in the past, we have always, after we've had some kind of crisis of this sort, we put in safeguards to prevent it from happening again.
Right.
We seem to be moving in the opposite direction this time.
Dodd-Frank had a few important pieces. The most important, the Volcker Rule, which Paul Volcker being one of the great titans of finance.
Which is under attack right now.
Precisely. I mean, so those few important things that were there are now being repealed or whittled away. The Volcker Rule, death by a thousand cuts. Volcker Rule, just for folks who don't know, said that banks that get a federal guarantee should not be able to use their own capital to trade in the market. In other words, we don't guarantee their money so they can then go out and play in a casino. We guarantee the funds so they can lend the way banks are supposed to lend. And this sort of diversion, this division we want between proprietary trading and lending, critically important. The banks, of course, want to be engaged in proprietary trading. They make a lot of money there or lose it, and then we step in to bail them out. And they are whittling that rule away, death by a thousand cuts.
Yesterday, Occupy Wall Street held protests around the city. Do you think that they have the potential to be a force in this year's presidential election?
I don't know. I was a big supporter last fall, and I think Occupy Wall Street played an instrumental role in changing our political conversation more than any elected official, more than any editorial page. Somehow they galvanized the sense. When we were in the middle of a debate only about budget cutting and austerity, they said, wait a minute, there are issues of fairness and equity that are not on the table. And it was a genuine grassroots movement that captured the public imagination last fall. I'll tell you the truth, I was a little bit disappointed yesterday. What I saw was, yes, some protests, but I don't see a game plan. And maybe I'm asking too much. Maybe this is unfair.
But they complain that people ask them for a game plan. That's not the way they deal with things. They are so democratic to the point where everybody yep. has a say. And to some, as in some cases, it just all evens out.
That is true. It may be a fair analysis of who they are and what they want to be. But if it's the case, then I think their capacity to change the conversation over the next 6 months will diminish.
They'll have less of an impact than the Tea Party, which they often are compared to.
The Tea Party latched on to candidates, had a structure. Things that I know there is sort of a democratized notion about the Occupy Wall Street movement, but structure helps in the long run if you want to be there as a presence.
The president recently signed the Jobs Act into law, which, among other things, will loosen restrictions on how small businesses raise money, including online crowdfunding. Mary Shapiro, the chair of the SEC, wrote a letter expressing her concerns about how the bill will undercut the SEC's assessment of new public offerings. But the bill did have bipartisan support. Is this the kind of financial legislation the only kind that can pass Congress now?
Well, I wrote an article harshly critical of the bill. And what the bill showed to me was that Wall Street still owns Congress. Congress jumped as high as it was told to jump when Wall Street said, we want these rules relaxed. Look, I'm in favor of making it easy and sensible for small businesses to raise capital. That's critically important. What this bill did, unfortunately, beneath the patina of nice positive language, was repeal some of the important rules relating to anti-fraud rules, that some of which had been put in place in a settlement I struck with Wall Street all the way back in 2003. Mary Shapiro, the head of the SEC, President Obama's own appointee, objected to the bill. So there are some problems with the bill. We want capital to be raised, but this bill was not the right vehicle.
My guest is Eliot Spitzer, and this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In the most recent of your biweekly columns for Slate, you wrote about what the Founding Fathers thought about mandates. The Founding right. Fathers thought about mandates?
Well, you know, remarkably they did. I don't think the word mandate was used. And this is an article that I wrote based on some research done by a Harvard Law School professor where he determined that there were three mandate equivalents passed by Congresses in 1790, 1792, and 1798, important because Founding Fathers, those who drafted the Constitution, actually participated in passing these bills. Bills were signed by President Washington and President John Adams. So the Founding Fathers passed bills requiring that companies that were running shipping companies buy health insurance for their sailors, a bill that required the sailors to buy health insurance. So if the argument by the conservative wing of the Supreme Court is going to be our Founding Fathers never would have envisioned government requiring people to participate in the market this way, wait a minute, guys, they did. So it's a fascinating historical rebuttal to the conservative argument.
Well, if the government didn't make that case in its presentation to the Supreme Court, can the Supreme Court still be apprised?
I suppose, yes. You can take judicial
you
notice.
Write a little note to Justice Scalia and Samuel Alito.
I'm not sure they're going to be open to my emailing them additional briefing on the matter. I think you can take judicial notice of these things. Now, those who object to the argument say, yes, but that was under the Maritime Clause or this or that. None of which matters. The point is these speak to the power that the Congress had.
Well, the Supreme Court will likely hand down its decision in June, and most observers think that they're going to strike down part or all of the law. Do you think that we'll be hearing more about health care reform throughout the campaign, or is this an issue that the president will go away?
No, we'll hear about it throughout the campaign. One side or the other will have a political rationale to raise it. Now, I'm not so persuaded they'll strike it down. And remember, Judge Silberman of the D.C. Circuit, extraordinarily conservative judge, upheld the law and was almost dismissive of the conservative critique of the law, saying, look, guys, Congress has this power. You may not like it. They have the power.
But most people are judging or that based on the way the questions were asked.
Correct.
And usually that does reveal where this, at least this court goes.
It reveals something. I will place – not a bet. I'll make a prediction. It's an outlier. 6-3, the statute's upheld.
The Supreme Court has already had an impact on this election with its decision in Citizens United, which opened the door to the super PACs that we've been seeing today. You support that decision, unlike most liberals.
Yes, let me make it clear why. I'm with the ACLU on this one. I think as a matter of First Amendment doctrine, the case was correct. It has opened a Pandora's box of issues that we need to deal with, such as disclosure of that super PAC money, very clear definition of what super PACs can and cannot do when they coordinate with candidates. Now, I'll personalize this a little bit. WNYC is a corporation. Not-for-profit court, it's a corporation. Should NYC and this program have a First Amendment right? I think it should. In other words, I think First Amendment rights relate to speech, not to the structure or nature of the voice. And so I am pretty close to a First Amendment absolutist because I live in great fear of the moment when this, when government of any sort could clamp down on speech. You know, this, as I said, the ACLU was agrees with my interpretation of this. I favor the First Amendment doctrine inherent in Citizens United, but no, we need to do much to repeal.
Now, how far do you want to go with that? If a guest says something, utters an obscenity, and we don't get rid of it, the FCC can take away our license.
You know, I'm not so sure that will continue to be the case for much longer.
Well, it was under the Bush administration. Yes. Now it's under the Obama administration.
It is the case right now, but I think over time – there may be some parameters of that sort that will continue to survive, but I would not want to see the First Amendment right of an entity, corporate, individual, or otherwise, taken away just as a matter of principle.
New York Senator Chuck Schumer has received millions of dollars in campaign contributions over the course of his career from financial institutions, more than almost all of his colleagues in the Senate. Have those contributions to him helped Wall Street get a voice in the Senate?
You know, look, Chuck is a friend. I've disagreed with Chuck about his perspective on Wall Street and a bunch of other issues, but as I say, he's a friend. I respect him. The last thing I would ever do is suggest that Chuck would be influenced by money. I don't want to believe that, and so I'm not going to suggest
it. Well, he often votes against his party on some of those issues.
He does. He has his view, and I don't agree with it, but I will tell you what his view is. His view is that finance is a New York-based industry. It's his job to protect it. I disagreed with him when I was in office, continue to, but I don't want to ever suggest Chuck is influenced by the money per se.
Well, during the debate over the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill, he and other members of New York's congressional delegation signed a letter that raised concerns over provisions of the bill that would have regulated derivatives. They said that they would put American bankers at a disadvantage with their global competitors. I suspect you would have taken a different position.
I would have taken many different positions than my colleagues as it related. And I will tell you, back when I was AG, I felt quite lonely. And I oftentimes would reach out to others to say, look, join me in this effort. There weren't many takers, but such is life.
On 60 Minutes, did you see it last Sunday?
With Jose Rodriguez?
Yes.
Yes, I did.
And he said that enhanced interrogation techniques used by the agency were key to finding Osama bin Laden.
Right.
And there are others who are saying that that's not true. Are you surprised that there hasn't been more reaction to his statements from either party?
You know, yes, I am. We did a segment on the show about this. We played outtakes from the Jose Rodriguez interview on 60 Minutes where he made the brazen claim, which has been refuted, as you say, by the chair, Democratic senators who are the chairs of the Armed Services and the Intelligence Committees.
And also the FBI.
And also the Inspector General of the CIA. The claim that enhanced interrogation or what we would call torture led to that information, simply wrong based on what we know. Now, I don't have the complete record, of course. I wish that issue continued to be one of debate, but neither party wants it to be a subject of debate, and it probably will not be.
And is that the reason you think the Obama administration has not gone after people like John Yoo?
I think, yes. I think that they're... Again, I don't want to say that Eric Holder made a political decision. I think that they said, you know what, these are very dicey cases. John Yoo, of course, wrote one of the torture memos that rationalized under a misinterpretation of law the capacity to waterboard people. I think the Justice Department said, let's look, as Eric Holder said, we will look forward, not back. The job of prosecutors is to look back.
Just one more thing. A guest on this show recently said that There are eight missing years, it seems, when we talk about what's happened in this country. Bill Clinton ended his presidency, and Barack Obama became the next president. Right. Why do you think that's happened? Are the Democrats just being wimps?
I don't quite know. It is amazing to me. I mean, I will interpret that as saying if we focused on the 8 years of George W. Bush and said, what are the historical lessons to be learned from this, then so much of what is being said right now by Mitt Romney and his allies would be deemed simply foolishness. And I wish I have asked the same question. We have forgotten the history. We are refusing to learn the lessons of history and to, you know, repeat the fame, what is now the cliche. Hence, we may relive it.
Do you think that Mitt Romney will be hurt by things like a foreign policy advisor having to resign because of pressure from conservatives, social conservatives, and the man is gay?
I hope he's hurt by it because it is such an abomination that happened. Having said that, I think the reality is that the presidential race will be determined by, I've said this for 2 years now, three numbers: the unemployment rate, the price of housing, the price of gas.
And perhaps some shocking thing that we cannot predict.
That's correct. There's always the uncertainty of what might happen.
Thank you so much for being on our show, Eliot Spitzer, now the host of Viewpoint with Eliot Spitzer on Current TV, weekday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern.
Pleasure to have been here. Thank you so much.